found out about this Marine Amateur Radio. All right, so, and I'm aware of the ICOM single sideband commercial rig that we're talking about, and if there's some way to put that on the ham band, that'd be great, because you know the space is at a premium, as you know, either in boats or cars for that matter, but rather than waste a lot of radio on a boat, it's only including a swim platform, it's only 30 feet long, so wasting a lot of that interior space is not something I want to do with a radio that I partially can't use, meaning I can't put it on 160 and such. But that was my other question, is what band did you achieve that on, and Ken, and I don't even know if ICOM still makes that radio anymore. It's very pricey, but if it saves you the price of a radio, you know, something for the ham bands, then it's probably worth it. And I do have a tuner available to me in terms of selection, the selection process that I think will go very well. And
a good portion of those ICOM radios have the transmit anywhere mod available, so you should be able to dial up whatever you need, John, without any trouble. Which model is it?
You're talking about the ICOM commercial?
Yeah, the Marine radio.
As far as I remember, there's only one of them. But I can't tell you what the numbers are at the moment. But it's got all the usual figures attached to it, except that legally you're not supposed to go over 150 watts on sideband, or at least that was the AM requirement. I don't know what it is now, but it's peculiar that you can only go to 150 watts on the marine band, but you can on the ham band. Of course, you can go to 1500 if you want, but of course the radio can't do that, not without help. As I remember, Gene was telling me he's got copies of this book by McGraw-Hill, so that would be good for any and everybody to look at it. By the way, Ameritron has a they have a tuner that is a lot cheaper than the commercial versions that are designed to take care of that and take care of the antenna requirements on a powerboat. You got to go to at least 18, preferably up to 20, 24, 25 feet, something like that, if you could possibly do it. In fact, I resurrected a very old antenna, plastic mast antenna from years and years ago that I may use for this project, just based on the fact that it's going to be for single sideband. And of course, combine it with a good power adapter or power, afterburner. Back to you, Gordon, and to NPR.
That's interesting. That's very, very interesting. All right. Well, we'll put that under advisement, John. That's kind of interesting problem. But 25 feet is kind of the minimum. 31 is probably another good choice. Then 43 is your next good choice. Your mileage may vary, of course, but good. Anybody else have any other advice for John? All right, John, I think we're going to wrap this up. Any final comments? Any final comments, John?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Not offhand. Antenna concern I'm concerning about is that, I'm up on a hill here that's about 800 feet up in the air. When the storms blow by here, they get very windy. And my TV antennas have held out beautifully only because I have guy wires on them. Putting ham radio onto and attaching them with the guy wires is another issue, I think, that would wind up disturbing the pattern on the antenna, but that's down the road, I guess, for me. Other than that, that's about all I'm thinking about these days. back to you, Glenn.
Well, if it's for a tower, you use Philly Strand. And if it's for something lighter, like a mast, use Black Dacron or Parachute Cord or whatever. Very good. All right. Andre, NTJDH, you've been patient, K2BAR.
K2BAR, N2JDH. All right, my question was on grounding and lightning protection. Pretty much I just wanted to know the proper length of a ground rod. I'm thinking it's 8 feet, but I'm not sure. And the gauge that's needed to run from the, let's say, a 4-to-1 ballon or the matching... I can't even think right now. But from the matching network down to the ground, and what are some good grounding habits? So let me send it back over to you. K2BAR, this is NTJDH.
Okay, well, boy, that's a loaded question. So 8-foot ground rod's a good choice. You know, keeping my lightning lights to go and the shortest, or electricity lights to travel the shortest possible distance. So sharp bends in your ground arrangements, the shortest possible to that ground rod, keep it as little possible, ice in your ground. Lightning protection is an interesting question. What is that? Expectations. A direct strike? Well, not a lot you can do. But nearby strikes, there's gas discharge tubes, there's kind that, in fact, I wished I had some of them here. The thing called a blitz bug that essentially a big spark gap kind of thing. Gas discharge tube ones are pretty good too. What's the brand? I use those with the replaceable slugs so that after they've been shot at, I replace them. Replace the little slugs. Someone want to help me out here with that. I'm trying to remember what they're called. They're bonded to my grounding plate, which is bonded to my ground. Over.
Gordon, leave some time for EchoLink to get in. I know BHZ wanted to talk about grounding. K2EIR.
Okay, sure. Let's do that. I got to bail in 10 minutes anyway. N2BA said maybe you can bring your topic into this too and we can answer your other.
Okay, this is N2VHC Mobile, Alliance, Nebraska. Hey, so Bob, I'm in the opposite direction now. You know, I've had a lot of stuff grounded, very well earth grounded, and to answer the question about the length of the ground rod, it depends on the conductivity of the soil, I believe. How much of a skin are you going to introduce to the soil and so forth. Like out here, you can forget it. It's one of the worst soil conductivity areas in the United States. Our sand is simply sand, you know, it's like a desert. That's what it is out here, a hard-packed desert. So anyway, what I was going to say is, I'll go right to the point. I lived in North Carolina, I had a G5 RV up. The antenna wasn't very high, it was about 30 feet at the peak, and the ends came down to about 6 feet. So I could walk under them, just rub the top of my head when I was cutting the lawn. No problem. Inverted V, right? Lightning strike 300 feet away, direct right in front of my face. The lightning hit, you felt the flash, you felt the heat, you were blinded, and then you heard the crack, and then you heard the sizzle of the tree that it hit, which was probably a 100-foot high tree in my front yard. But in the backyard, I had none of my amateur gear grounded. I had about 4 HF radios going, not turned on, but none of them were grounded. They were not connected to the antenna either. I never leave anything connected down in North Carolina to such a frequency with the lightning strikes, very, very frequent. But because my antenna was ground independent and any antenna I had, I would like to say that I believe that avoided any extraneous static or any kind of electrical charge from entering that because it did not have the electrical field seeked out a close path to ground, which my antenna did not introduce into that field. What do you think about that, Gordon? Back to you.
Yeah, well, certainly by isolating things, it's fine if you can maintain that, totally isolated. But keep in mind that things like speaker leads and microphone leads and computer interconnect cables, the computer that might be connected to a ground through its power leads, that all could play in. Now, maybe at the time you didn't have all that schmutz there, and that saved you, but you have to worry about all these other ancillary paths to ground. Regarding grounding, if you live in an area where you have poor ground conductivity, a couple of things you can do, and maybe Rick can help me with this, diatomaceous clay, I think, is highly conductive. And what some people will do is they will take a post hole digger and dig a 4 foot or an 8 foot hole, where they'll get an auger and drill a hole, fill the hole with this clay, pound their ground rod into that, and now you've got something that's got a foot around, or maybe even several feet around if it's a 1 foot hole, if the diameter is pretty big. And now you've got an 8 foot cylinder of conductive stuff into the soil, and that's how people get decent grounds in places like where you can. So back to Andre first, and then to Ken.
K2BAR and 2JDH. All right, that pretty much answered my question. I was pretty much trying to peek around to or poke around to figure out, what I need to do for lightning protection. I'm guessing, discharge tube, the gas discharge tube, and having a good soil, I guess it's a good electrical conductive soil would probably be the best. So I know where to go from there, and that clay is probably a good idea. I'm thinking if I ever put a ground in, then I'm best off with just getting some type of conductive soil and putting it in place right before I put the rod in. That way I don't have that issue with it. So pretty much, it was answered. So let me send it over to N2VHZ. This is N2JDH.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, what I was trying to say, to associate this with something else, I lived in a place where they came out with a law, a federal law, that all structures over a certain height, certain amount of occupancy, this and that, will be grounded and have lightning spikes presented as a sacrifice to the lightning. That's the way I put it. And of course, it's what's completely different in the way that they wrote it for the government purposes. But it was the country of Germany, and in Germany, they've never had so many houses get hit by lightning until they started introducing these lightning rod systems on their roofs of their houses. And when I was living there, they told me, when you put your antenna up, you got to ground it really well, because we get a lot of lightning strikes lately since this law has passed. I said, so you mean to tell me, before you started introducing sacrifices to the lightning gods, you were not being hit so often? They said, never, never. Now that the law came up, they have to produce these series of more or less of a top hat of grounding, and then every village has got some kind of catastrophe happening lately. So even over there, I had a discussion with my landlord saying, well, what if I independently float my antenna with no grounding represented at all off the roof? Therefore, your roof will get hit, but not my antenna. He says, actually, let's try that. Let me tell you something. Never had a problem with it by not grounding it, because it was independent. It was just sitting up there, and the lightning never saw it because it did not represent a path to ground. So it would never actually get a direct strike like most people think. But even still, any kind of field never actually affected that antenna either, because it was independent. So I'm kind of like the anti-grounding guy here. I'm like devil's advocate. Over to you, Gordon.
I have a comment, Gordon.
Go ahead, John.
One of the, about 2 years ago, my neighbor and I had in common a In between our houses, we had a huge lightning strike, and my neighbor lost all of the electronics in his house. And I think he actually lost a refrigerator. I think it was closer to his house than it was to mine, but I don't know that for sure. But the point being that he had absolutely no protection whatsoever. And he had a microwave dish on the roof, you know, from his old pizza dish satellite days, and like that. But I didn't get any damages at all. And the reason for that, I believe, is I had surge protectors all over the house, and it really helped. I had one surge protector that looked like it was, the one surge protector in my house that was closest to his house. That one had burn marks on it. This is again, I guess you classify this as a nearby lightning strike. Let me let this drop. And success that I was able to enjoy, I think, was based on the fact that there were surge protectors all over the house. So it's not just one protector that's helping you. It's the numerical numbers that help you, because you're not asking one protector to take care of one thing. You're asking protectors to respond to the same incident, and therefore give you that much more protection by virtue of its numbers. Numbers of units. And of course, the electrical service has to be grounded by law around here anyway, and that also helps as well. With that, I'll send it back to you, Gordon. W2TTTN2NBR. W2TTT. Well, at this time I must go. This hockey game is in 2 minutes. A minute and a half, I can just walk in and watch it, but I just want to thank everybody for a nice net. This net can continue. I'll tell you what, how are you still with us?
Yeah, but I'd like to get out of here too.
All right. I don't have the option, so. All righty. Andre, you can continue to run the net. What the heck? Good topic. So keep this going, and I want to thank everybody for their words and great thoughts, but I must make like a tree and leave. So, thank you, Service Radio Co-Producer Peter. That will continue, and you guys can close it at will. And to JDH, and then whoever else, and then don't forget Ken, K2BAR. Severy for now.
Hey, three guys, K2EIR closing.
Enjoy your hockey, Gordon. Ken, are you still there?
Yeah, man. Today is 23rd April, 1516. Germany enacted the Reinheitsgebot. That is the purity law of beer sold in Germany. Just wanted to share that with everybody. I'm here.
The name of the company you can get at the, surge protectors are made by Belkin. There's many other manufacturers, but that happens to be the one that Home Depot sells around my neck of the woods here. B-E-L-K-I-N. Baker, Edwards, Linear, Kenwood, Information, Nancy. B-E-L-K-I-N. And they're about, I guess they run about $5 a piece, plus or minus depending. How many outlets and like that, but it's really well worth it. If you don't have them and you get hit, you're going to curse yourself, and if you do have them and you get hit, you're going to be very proud of yourself for having many of these strewn around your house as best you can. With that, I got to say 7-3, which I tried to do a little while ago, and thanks to this very fascinating subject that Andre brought up, grounding and lightning. I have two issues for grounding myself. One is near the station here, and the other is nearest the antenna. So I don't know which one of those I should really depend on. Maybe I should use both. But anyway, Kenny, back to you and to NPR.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thanks for the tip, Belkin. I know what you're saying. I'm familiar with that. And when I worked for the phone company, we only used 4-foot,
galvanized rods. We didn't use copper, brass, it was galvanized steel. And when I lived in Augsburg, I had a bus bar behind my equipment, and I ran a ground wire, a heavy gauge ground wire, directly, a home run right to the ground rod outside. I drilled a hole right through the wall, actually, just for that heavy gauge wire. Ran all my equipment on a bus bar right out. And then the tower, I had actually grounded also independently. Even though it wasn't concrete, I did drive a 4-foot ground rod in next to it. And I enjoyed that very much. It never had a problem. They did have a lot of lightning storms up in Suffolk County, and I never had a problem there. But, yeah, okay, I guess the price of the surge protectors has become more reasonable. And I have quite a few, actually, out here in my house. And, yeah, I have a different setup, totally different setup. And everything's pretty safe right now, but hopefully this was brought up and to the, you know, the information was disseminated quite well to the people that want to hear this kind of stuff. Thank you for counting me in. 73 and from the HC out.
82 CAK.
Go ahead, CAK.
I just caught the last 10 or 15 minutes of this, so I hope I don't throw in any redundant information. There are these little lightning arrestors that go right between your radio and the antenna wire. For a basic radio, they start around $30. They're often made by Jetstream or FFJ or a few other companies, I'm sure. And most people, I think, only experience sort of a secondary hit. Unless you're like the tallest thing out there, chances are you get what, you know, you don't really experience the direct hit. You just get the flash that comes off of it. The direct hit, I don't know that there's anything you can really do with that. If that's a god thing, I guess, to be part of that. Back to that.
Andre, you still there?
Yes, I am. Zen 2 JDH.
Also, if ever you are in a situation where you have a choice between a house, if you're going to buy a house, always buy a house that has BX on it, as opposed to the stuff that does not have cladding, you know, copper or steel cladded wiring. It makes a huge difference on a lot of levels. With that, I got to be traveling on. Andre, we'll catch you later down the road, and good luck in your situation there. But I got to sign, guys. Everybody have a good night, and we'll catch you down the log. And to NBR's listening out, saying 73 to all on board.
With the proliferation of PVC, excuse me, you also have to be careful about using plumbers around these days. 73's off.
Okay, so I'm guessing everybody's going from the net. I did write down an information that into NPR said about the Belkin surge protectors into VHZ. He offered up the 4-foot galvanized bar. That's something I definitely want to look into. And he did a bus bar straight from the from his station to the ground rod. I've actually heard of that being done. So and as well as KE2CAK sharing several different manufacturers of lightning suppressors between the cable and the antenna setup itself. So that's some good information. Definitely. I'll make sure I get this over to Gordon so he can add this to the group email, so we don't lose any of this information. I'm just going to make a final call, see if there's anybody else listening in before I say my 73s. So I'll leave it out there for anybody for a minute or two to come back to me. This is N2JDH.
W82ISC.
N2VHZ with another comment.
Station WA2, I believe that's India Sierra Charlie.
Okay, WA2 India Sierra Echo, just listening and just wanted to see how my signal's getting out. I repaired my antenna, had a bad loading coil and whatnot, then I basically modified it to become a 5/8 whip using some rods off of an old TV antenna. Over.
Just with a slight hum. Other than that, you're making making it to the repeater with a beautiful signal. You're clear, reliable. It's as if there was nothing wrong with that antenna. Like I said, you're making it into the repeater with no problem. This is N2JDH.
Okay, N2JDH, WA2ISC, clear.
All right, with that, I'm going to say my 73s as well. So 73, if anybody else is out there, I'll be listening for another minute or two. This is N2JDH, and I'll be clearing up in a few.
Ken still had another comment out there.
N2JDH, this is N2VHC.
All right, go ahead, Ken.
My buddy CAK tightened me right up. Thank you very much. Sorry. So, what I wanted to say, I wanted to make that perfectly clear. See, on the back of the radios, sometimes there's a place for grounding, you know? And off that thumb screw or whatever it had on the back of certain radios that I had at the time, I had ran a short, heavy gauge, braided, copper braided, piece of metal to, it's actually almost like cloth, it feels so nice, but it's braided metal to a heavy copper bus bar that I've acquired from some ham fest or something, and screwed within short distances. Everything went in short distances. So this bus bar sort of ran, behind the radios, parallel with the radio back planes, and a short connection of braided, heavy gauge braided copper clad metal went to the bus bar. That bus bar in turn was connected to a heavy gauge solid copper wire which ran directly through the wall of the house and straight down. The radio shack, the room, was on the second floor. So I ran it down the outside wall of the house and right into a 4-foot galvanized rod in the ground alongside the house. That was the radio ground, for the chassis ground for the radio, period, right there. And then that was a combination with what they call polyphaser. Polyphaser is a company that makes ground protection for lightning and surge arresting and stuff. Polyphaser makes a gas discharge system, which is something like Gordon was describing. It's a component about half the size of a pack of cigarettes. It goes in line with two female connectors. And sometimes they're for the different bands that you're going to operate, HF, VHF, UHF. They can form these things to be almost RF invisible. So there's almost no loss in your line if you put this polyphaser component in line. And what it has is it has a gas discharge cartridge that you insert. It's sort of like a little glass fuse. You insert it side to side of this Bakelite component made out of Bakelite, and what happens is when the lightning or a large amount of voltage comes down your cable, it will discharge through that gas tube as a fuse, and it will break the connection going into your radio somewhere on the coax. And a lot of people like to put it near the radio, and a lot of people like to put it halfway through, and a lot of people like to put it by the antenna. So it's up to you, but it's a small component. They come particularly made for certain bands, VHF, UHF, or HF, because they have to be RF transparent, so there's no loss.
So repeater. Repeater. Timeout. Clear.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Ken, sorry about that. Yeah, the repeater timed out on that transmission. But I got most of that with the polyphasers. I'm actually familiar with that one. In fact, my ammo square has one just behind the radio. Let's say about a good 4 feet between the radio and the feed line as it comes into the building. So I'm definitely familiar with that. I don't know if you have anything else you want to share, so I'm going to hand it back over to you and see if there's anything else. This is N2JDH.
thing, I'll keep it short. When I was a lineman for the phone company up on Secaucus Road and County Road in Secaucus, we were putting up stranded support cable, and we normally would bond that to ground somewhere along the line, and we neglected to do that. So there was a level of stranded metallic support cable up there, just hanging along, maybe about 2,000 feet of it, 10 pole lengths. And we got a call in one night that, you got to see this, this is really weird. So we go up there, and that was the job we were working on, and we approached it up on County Road, up on Secaucus Road, Secaucus Road. There was a diner up there called Big Ed's, right across the street from there. And never forget this, there was a plasmatic effect happening where the lightning hit somewhere miles away, and it went down the pole line, and before it dissipated, the ground, apparently somewhere it dissipated along the line, but some of it continued down and found our ungrounded sections that we put up, and it caused a huge spark, maybe 8 feet long, to go from our cable to the next cable above it, which was the ground side of the power company, and it floated back and forth between there, making a loud buzzing sound, and we called that a plasmatic effect. And it was making all different kinds of colors and stuff, and we had, the power company had to come, PSEG had to come and ground that, because that was beyond our capability and equipment that we have. We had to safeguard it until then. So even if you don't ground stuff and it's independently floating, it can get hit and it can retain a voltage within it until it finds a way to dissipate the ground, which is kind of freaky. It's something you don't see every day. Back to you.
Yeah, I never saw that when I was working underground at PSTNG. Everything we did was underground, and it always arced. So I never got to see some of that stuff. But that sounds cool. As crazy as it sounds, it is cool, and probably as dangerous as possible. But you know, I guess we learn from as we go along. So you said that stranded support cable was unbonded. And that's caused that the plasmatic effect.
Yeah, well, when the PSEG guys rolled up, goes, didn't you guys run like a temporary ground? Like we had this cable with these giant alligator clips on it, and like you should have ran that to the ground wire. And I says, nah, we forgot to. And they says, you know, don't forget anymore, more or less. And it was just, more was said than that, but. It's funny because we forgot to do that. You're supposed to temporarily ground it. Yeah, it was like maybe, let's say 20 pole lengths that weren't grounded at all. It was just floating on the hangers. And it was going all the way up and all the way down, all the way up, all the way down. It was like something out of a science fiction movie. Never seen that before. And he says, yeah, it's in our ground and it's seeking out another path and it's found yours, and yours is representing some kind of a place for it to play around with. You know, if it was one section, that's one thing. It's different. It probably wouldn't have done it. But you left so much up there that it actually sees it as part of a circuit, you know, a parallel circuit it created. It was really weird. And he also said it might have had, when we pulled it out of the reel, it builds up static as you're pulling it off the reel on the ground. And a lot of times you're supposed to let a ground rod touch that reel and bounce up and down on it at an angle, and then that ground rod is bonded to another ground rod, which is driven in the ground. So any static electricity that builds up with that spinning reel, that wooden reel that spins with the strand on it, that would be dissipated by the ground rod that's bouncing up and down, laying against it on the strand. We didn't do that either. He thinks there might have been some small static electricity left on that, creating a small parallel circuit. But they got it all straightened out. Back to you.
Connected. N2OEL.
N2OEL checking in.
N2OEL, N2JDH. Yeah, Gordon, pretty much let the technic run with individuals around about 10:30. We were just pretty much going back and forth on grounds and out. Sign. I really gotta get up and know Ken is still out there. I'm not sure if you want to hold a Q-cell with Ken, but I gained a lot of information from Ken, and I wish I can keep this Q-cell going. But I'll let you guys continue the queue, so I'm actually getting ready to sign. I got to get some rest. Ken, thank you again for that information. N2VHZ, this is N2JDH. You have N2OEL out there. 73, you guys.
See if I have it, KD2CAK. 73s, and thanks, Andre. And Ken, I'm curious whether you use the a separate ground or the same ground for your lightning arresters as you did for, you know, say, the grounds on the back of your rigs, assuming you were using them at all. And Noah, always good to hear you. Good evening. This is REKD2CAK. And I'm going to throw it over to Noel because he just got here, and then you can throw it over to Ken.
I don't know if it's me, Ari, but I think he just dropped off echo. He sounded like he might have been on echo link. He came out so loud out of my speaker, but I think he just got disconnected. I'm going to pause for a minute and see if he can come back in. I think it's N2OEL. This is N2VHZ.
Sorry, gentlemen. If I touch this cell phone wrong, it disconnects. I am in Gulfport, Mississippi. I'm using EchoLink on my iPhone 6 over the Bell network, not over a Wi-Fi, because there's none here where I'm located. I just put a ground rod in my house in Ocala. What I did is I ran behind the wall where the station's located. I ran 3 8-foot steel copper clad ground rods, sunk 7'6" into the ground. I'm using 6-gauge wire and bonding them to the two ground rods going one way, and then to a water faucet, then two in one ground rod again, and the other ground rod, and then to another water faucet, and that's 6-gauge wire, and that's going to be the ground for my station. Hopefully there's not going to be need for lightning ground since the wires are in the attic, and hopefully that'll be able to dissipate the static electricity through, if nothing else, the water pipe ground. And I just hope I have a ground here. My soil is so sandy, and they tell me the clay soil is 7, 6 to 8 feet down, depending where you are. So my ground situation is interesting. So this is N2OEL back to you.
Hey. Very good on the setup. Ken, Kilo Echo November. Ken is my name. Nice to meet you. I'm located in Alliance, Nebraska. I'm in the western panhandle of the state of Nebraska. Yeah, the net at the end became, I always come in at the end because I'm on EchoLink and they call EchoLink last, but I always try to bring questions up to the net to keep the stimulation high, you know, and they always lead me to the end and then everybody's gone by then. So I think, you know, I only have a few people that stick around to keep going with this stuff. And Ari, thank you for coming in and supporting my question. The answer to your question is no. Neither of those two were connected, actually, by that cable or by that heavy-gauge copper wire. The radios were grounded in their own ground rod, and the tower was grounded on its own ground rod. But the shield of the coax does have continuity with the back plane of the radio, obviously. And that shield of that coax did go up to the tower, did have continuity all the way to the tower. So if I took an ohm meter and touched the back of the radio, and I touched...
Repeater. Repeater, timeout, clear.
All right, I guess we timed it out again. That's a problem not having it in net mode there, but we should let it drop a little bit more often. Ken, you got cut off, I'd say right around. You were telling us you used two separate ground systems. And Noel, you did miss two interesting tidbits for your situation earlier in the conversations. One of which Gordon was saying, in a lot of areas people will make a 1-foot post hole
and fill it with a type of clay that is highly conductive before putting their ground rod in order to give them, you know, up to an 8-foot sphere of extra conductivity there. And my warning was that a lot of the plumbing you got to watch out for, because it's not always metal all the way down to the ground floor anymore. There's a lot of PVC over there. I'm going to try throwing it back over with a space in between to Alliance, Nebraska again, and then you throw it over to OEO.
Yeah, very good. Sorry about that timeout. Yeah, I was saying I have two different ground potentials for the fact that when I disconnect my coax to my radio, it does not have continuity any longer up the tower, so therefore the tower is grounded independently right into the earth as opposed to being set to cement, and the station itself is grounded independently because I used to unhook my antennas all the time. I was saying that if you take an ohm meter to the back plane of my radio, you can touch the tower with it and get a direct short. That's because the antennas were connected. But when I disconnected them, I needed to have two separate grounds. I used to always disconnect my antennas when I didn't use the radio, whether there was a storm or not coming. Physically unhook them, you know? And, I understand what you mean by that. They're actually promoting PEX. PEX is a new formulated type of plastic that they can make the transition from copper or PVC over to PEX. And PEX uses a whole arrangement of certain types of tools. But the PEX plumbing, it's easier to install because there's no soldering or nothing, and you can make different kind of radius bends with it and use certain kinds of crimps. And supposedly, PEX lasts a lifetime. Supposedly, but who knows, really, right? But that's the new plumbing is PEX, which is plastic. Over to you, N2OEL is such a VHC.
Now, what's interesting is I heard everything Ken said because we were both on Echolink, and Echolink didn't time out. So I heard everything he was saying because it comes direct. My house in New Jersey has a couple different ground rods coming in, and I tie all my ground rods together with a minimum of 6-gauge copper wire, bare wire, that I bury 6 inches in the ground just to add to the ground system. It's hard to bury it much more than that when you're making a slit trench, so to speak. The reason I ground them all together is ground loops are when you have a resistance of some sort between two different grounds and you get hum. But if you put a 6-gauge copper wire, don't get a hum-inducing ground loop. Now, my house up in western New York, I have a 105-foot ground rod there. It's a 6-inch steel pipe casing, and you never live till you try to solder to a steel pipe casing. When I finally had something...
Repeater, timeout, clear.
You guys were just able to go on talking, but I'm here again, KD2, CAK.
When did you hear him get cut off, Ari? See, it's funny, we're on Echolink and we hear each other perfectly, and we don't ever hear the repeater. We hear everything each other say, we don't know when we get cut off. That's the weird thing about it. The Echolink never drops us, and we don't know that we get to continuously hear each other. What was the last thing you heard from him, Ari? I was curious.
To solder something to a steel pipe and somebody was going to manufacture it quick.
Hey man, you got some patience to sit on that end of it and take it. You know, Echolink has really become a kind of a monster in a way, you know? With this, you know, timing out normal RF repeaters and stuff, and I think Echolink ought to have a mandatory timeout. Whenever you connect to a repeater, the Echolink will have a timeout that is the equivalent of the repeater timeout. That would be a cool thing to have in there, because I could see how this is causing problems on some people's repeaters, especially this one. And you, the poor guy, has to sit there and endure moments of silence, hearing people get cut off and waiting for them to stop talking, you know? And it's not our fault, per se, because we don't know
what the time limit is on certain repeaters. Back to you, Ari.
How often during a net are repeaters put into a net mode where it doesn't time out? But with that being said, my particular radio, the Handy Talkie, has a little timeout feature in it. I time it out before I'll time out a repeater. 9 times out of 10, the Handy Talkie will drop first. I know you often interface with the radio, so you might have that feature, whereas Echolink has probably not installed it for Noel's convenience. Either way, it's been a while since we've heard from him. Let's let it drop in between each person and see if that helps, and I'm going to try throwing it back over to Noel.
Well, I counted 6 before picking it up. I should know what the time is on this repeater since I'm a member of the Chestnut Ridge Radio Club. And Jim, K2FJ, actually has the Echolink set up in his house, running on a computer and a small transmitter that transmits a RF signal to the repeater as if it was a Handy Talkie or something similar. He's got a good shot to it, so I don't think he needs more than a couple watts of power. So we are actually, even though we're on Echolink, we are putting RF into the repeater from Jim's house. Back to you, Ari.
I think we're best to keep that under our hats for now, although it does open the door to possibly have any timeout feature installed on our end, which is a good thing. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops there. Again, I'm going to let it drop in between and throw it on the ID, KD2CAK, and I'm going to throw it over again.
Yeah, it's sent to VHC Mobile, Alliance, Nebraska. Yeah, that's called a link radio. That's why he uses the L after it. Now I got it now. I figured they had a link radio. That's how I have the setup also, a link radio. That's interesting. You know, yeah, my radio beeps every 60 seconds, and when I hear two beeps, I stop. But it seems like the repeater accumulates time when other people talk if you don't give it the time to recycle in between, and that's the big problem right there. Not giving enough time in between key-ups. Yeah, so that's interesting. And you know, Ari, another thing, and I guess the other gentleman's name is Noel. That's interesting. N-2-O-E-L. That's your name. So your call sign is actually your name, which is, that's pretty nice, you know. I wish I could get a call sign like that. K-2-E-N. Ken. That would be nice. I should put it for a vanity call. Yeah, Ari, the other night last night I was talking to a young guy on here about DMR radio. You know, the digital mode radios that are coming in through the back door of ham radio. They're starting to overwhelm ham radio now, and everybody's going to start going digital. And it's like a little niche in the market that's going to start coming in. And I was boning up on a little bit of DMR stuff today because I felt a little inept about the whole subject yesterday. And found out quite a bit of information about DMR. Are you using, or are you planning to go into digital mode radio at all? Either you, Noel, or you, Ari. Back to you, Ari.
I did a lot of reading up on it. I've heard a lot of happy comments about it. It's another one of those forms that requires repeaters that are going to be compatible in your area. I know that's a problem over there in Nebraska for you. It's supposed to be very interesting, and, you know, to me it seems akin to Echolink that people want to make these digital communications, you know, HF, DX, through a Handy Talkie. I find it interesting as a ham. I'd like to have all modes, but I'm not sure that I know enough about it to really think of it as a ham mode, sort of, you know, like Echolink. If the internet's gone, I don't know what happens to that radio. And I hate to see, you know, a lot of interesting people sort of get split up in the hobby, not talking to each other. But I've been promised that just because people do the DMR, that doesn't mean they won't come back to HF, but I don't know. Over to you, Noel, with the drop in between.
I'm counting 8 before I pick up. There's an article in this month's USD I think it was this month, it might be last month, that I just read, explaining all about all of this dual radio mode on FM, mostly. And basically, it's going to be old beta versus VHF. Which one do you pick? Which one's going to be the winner? Well, VHS, the inferior format, killed beta because it was an open standard, while beta was closed standard to Sony. And it seems that anybody who doesn't open standard will eventually prevail in the marketplace. However, there are some repeaters on one and some repeaters on the other. And until the dust settles, which will probably be 3 to 5 years, I would not invest in a digital FM unit for $300 or $400 that may become obsolete in the near future. Over to you, Ken, to Zen2OEL.
Okay, this is N2BHC, right back. I did a little research. I've seen some of them use TDMA, time division, and some of them use FDMA, frequency division. And I noticed that over in Europe, they're already using it on an unlicensed citizen band called PMR. I was quoting to this young man last night the wrong words. I was using MERS, it's not PMR. It's a band that they use in the 440 band over there. It's unlike CD band, and they also use digital mode on that PMR band, and that's using the FDMA format, and that is used by Kenwood, it's used by ICOM, and it's used by Yaesu, different names they use, and each one has a different codec to decode their voice in their own way, so they're still not compatible with each other, which is strange. So just like normal VHF, and beta. And then we come over to the Moto Turbo, their version, which they're using in the States. And that's using a time division version, the TDMA, which is not compatible with the ones I just mentioned. And all the Chinese radios are going to be using TDMA. And they're all going to be using what they call an open source codec. So they're all using, a different format, but they're all in compliance with each other, decode each other's voices to be able to hear it and remodulate it. So here we go again with VHS and beta, So I'm with Noel. I would stand back for 3 or 4 years before I invest one dime in this. Back to you, Ari. And I'm with you, Ari, with different modes, sideband and so forth. Over to you.
Well, the joy is that most people like to hear that FM quality signal like we're experiencing now, and that's what the digital is supposed to be doing. I don't like advertising different radios over the airwaves, but the big hubbub in this area is being caused by a radio called the CS700, which is a analog/digital handy talkie that I think runs the Moto Turbo mode. I'm a little over my head getting as specific as you were. But more or less, it seems to be available for hams from $180 to $240, something like that. And they've been very happy with it, and it seems to be a mode that has caught fire recently, and the price versus, I think they can also possibly be used on some of those bands where you would otherwise have to buy a $1,200 radio. So they've received some popularity. They're also good as an analog radio, and the deal, you have to buy them either UHF or VHF, and then it has the DMR mode. The idea is to find out if there's a DMR repeater in your area, and whether it's 2 meter or 4 meter first. Excuse me, 2 meter or 440. And if you want to look it up, I think it's called the CS700 or 701 there. Back to you, Ken.
Go ahead, Noel. I understand exactly what you're saying. What do you think, Noel? What's your opinion about that?
Well, actually, I don't have an opinion on which is the best format. I didn't actually read much about that, as I said in the RST article. I expect that at Dayton, there'll be some symposium And I was just laying here thinking, isn't it strange? Here I am in Gulfport, Mississippi, talking to a person in Nebraska and New Jersey, and we're both a repeater that's in Jersey. So anybody in the northern New Jersey area could actually hear our conversation, and I guess it goes over to Ari.
Don't blame me, guys. I'm on RF here. Hi, hi. If anybody wants to join us, please come ahead in a moment. And, yeah, if you guys want to read up on that, that's where I, you know, got some information. I just hate to see the hobby split like that, you know, in terms of people who... I heard a guy say he liked it better than his HF radio for $180. I was taken aback by that. But it's all possible. And let's see if anybody else is out there, and then back over to Ken.
Yeah, okay, I'm on an HT right now because I'm out of the vehicle, but I'm on an HT, hopefully it's going to be clear. It's interesting because I work with this NextEdge or NXPN system, as they call it, NXPN. Both ICOM and Kenwood came together and agreed on a common codec and a protocol that they're going to use for the commercial side of it, but it hasn't been offered to the amateurs in this country yet. They're using it over in Europe right now, working the bugs out, which is very interesting because I talked to the reps of both those companies, and they said they came to an agreement so that way the radios that are used most commonly in the industry are going to be compatible, you know, with no consideration for the hams. It almost seems like the ham radio guys are jumping on something before it needs to be jumped on, you know, and, I'm big into HF. When I had that conversation last night, I had advised the young man, first thing you should do is go out and buy a beautiful HF radio. That'll be the cornerstone of any ham radio hobby that'll last you the rest of your life. It's a very well constructed and mid-priced, full-size base station for FSD. And then you can get true worldwide communications with people in these very obscure third world locations where you don't have internet, you know. You'll talk to people in islands in the middle of nowhere that don't possibly have internet connections, as we're talking about with this conversation here. And it's more, I find it in my case more like ham radio. So Noel, what are you doing down in Shreveport, Mississippi, wherever you're at? What are you doing down there? And sounds pretty interesting. I'm in there probably the total opposite. I'm up here where we have winter time, like 6 months out of a year, and you guys don't even see a flake of snow down there. Back to you, Noel.
Well, I recently retired, so I have a house where it just snowed, by the way, in Penn Yan, New York, which is the western New York Finger Lakes region. I'm eventually going to sell my house in northern New Jersey and retire it because, of course, I got too many houses. Have a house in Ocala, Florida, but right now it's been running up in the high 80s, pushing 90. And I visited my brother in Lucedale, Mississippi, which is about 40 miles west of Mobile, Alabama. And then I came over and visited, right now, my sister in Gulfport, Mississippi, and I'm about 60 miles from New Orleans. That's how far west I am. And Saturday, I'm going to go back to Lucedale, and then Sunday, I'm going to drive back to Ocala. Lucedale to Ocala is about 504 miles. And of that, I would say it's a couple hundred miles south, and 300 miles east. The southern part is the part that makes it interesting. So you can just pick a temperature you want. If it's too cold, go to Ocala. A little bit too hot there, come up to visit my brother. Up too hot there, go to New Jersey. My stuff gets too hot there, go up to Western New York. I'm going to be a gypsy. And to a...
What do you think about that, Ari? It sounds like James Bond almost, with his moving to these different locations. I think he's a Russian spy.
I've met Noel, and, you know, I think it's very cool that he gets around in a major way. That being said, I'm wondering whether he's going to come visit us in any of these ham fests up in New Jersey. Probably be too hot for him to come up.